You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we are in Sagunto.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in Port de Sagunto in Spain.
I think you've already had this conversation that this is... Should I introduce myself?
Yeah.
Sorry, Rich, you want to introduce me? It's a bit weird if I do it myself. It's a bit Samuel Sanchez-esque. I'm the Olympic champion.
This is Richard Moore. That's television's Daniel Freed. Anyway. That was Lionel Burney. And we are, of course, joined as ever by our Spanish friend who played us in last night, Fran Reyes. And Fran, actually, you were going to give us a little blast of song tonight.
Oh, yeah. Because today we began near the Yellow Submarine.
Oh, yes.
Yellow Submarine. Yellow Submarine.
Beautiful. Oh, I've got so much to talk about now.
This is a reference to Spanish Watford, Villarreal, a team that's come up from the lower divisions and made a real splash in Spanish football. They came up in the very late 90s, didn't they? And they became a sort of fixture in the Champions League and at the top.
I was devastated to find out today that it's no longer called El Madrigal. It's called El Estadio de Cerámica.
Yeah. Nuevo Estadio de Cerámica because the owner of Villarreal, Francisco Roche, is one of the most important businessman here in Spain, and he made his best part of his fortune out of ceramics.
That's disappointing, isn't it? How would a ceramic submarine do? Would it be all right? Would it float? Would it sink? I don't know.
I've actually got a ceramic hip, I don't float. Because of everything that's around it. I'm not sure.
Should we deal with the football straight away tonight? Get it out of the way in the first 2 minutes of the podcast. As an homage to the Vuelta stage starting outside El Madrigal, Dutch crew, I can't remember which channel they're from, but colleagues, good friends of ours, and they wanted to do a football type feature, football themed feature, and they had a football with them at the start this morning.
It was a golden football.
Was it?
I didn't see it. I saw Nicky Terpstra
doing keepers, and
it was pathetic.
I was about to say, if you could pick out one rider who would be, I hate to say it, but a terrible footballer, a really uncoordinated footballer, my money would have been on Nicky Terpstra, and sure enough, two kick-ups.
I mean, one and a half, really. I mean, the second kick-up only really counted because it just happened to land back down on the same foot that he kicked the ball up with the first.
Connor Dunn would be a good sort of Peter Crouch figure, or perhaps a good centre-half, maybe. Connor Dunn?
Yeah. I mean,
Good in the air.
Very good in the air, you know. Great for sort of Irish type football, you know.
Singing about Conor Dunn in a cycling context. He's good in the air. He's really good in the air. Anyway,
I was going to say something else, Rich.
Oh, sorry.
Before that, and then I lost my train of thought. Fran, today we've got a bit of a linguistical issue. We've got linguistical problems to resolve. So we're in the Comunitat Valenciana, and today's stage finish was in Sagunt or Sagunto or Sagunte Sagunto.
Neither of the three.
Wow.
It was actually in Puerto de Sagunto. You know, thing is, in Valencia, in the Comunidad Valenciana, there is a separate branch of the Catalan language, which is Valencia. It bears a lot of similarities to Catalan, but has some little difference that make it a different language. And in Valencian, this would be the Port de Sagunt, because Sagunt, the actual town is 5 kilometers inland. This is its seaside.
And I heard yesterday that Alberto Contador has a house.
We're going to hear about that. We're going to hear about that in an interview coming up on this episode. Don't spoil it. Spoiler alert. Lionel Burney, tale of the tapas, please.
Tale of the tapas. Last night's tapas was really
it was excellent.
You had tapas last night?
Well, no, not really. We had a kind of big tapas. We had huge tomatoes. They were absolutely... They were
doped.
They were dope tomatoes. They were really nice, actually. I photographed it and put it on Twitter, and people said, oh, that looks horrible. But it was actually very nice. Followed by Richard had some cod, and I had some pork in a rich sauce. It was absolutely delicious. Very nice. That was in Castellón, where we were last night.
Sauce, wasn't it?
Well, anyway, stage six of the Vuelta from outside Villarreal's football stadium to Sagunto or Sagunt, depending on... Well, I wasn't really paying attention. I was like this in at school, really. I took in a bit of it, but I've forgotten now exactly what Fran said.
There's that hyphen in Villarreal as well, which I don't know what it's doing there.
That's Valencian as well. Villarreal instead of Villarreal.
Okay.
Well, anyway, it was 204 kilometres the way the race came. And the stage finished with a Polish 1-2, with Tomasz Marcinski of Lotto Sudal beating Paweł Poliański of Bora Hansgrohe at the finish. Enric Mas of Spain was third for Quickstep. They'd all been in a 37-man break that went clear after quite a lot of hard racing. They didn't get clear until around about 50 kilometres. It was one of those days where loads happened, and yet the finish was relatively straightforward and simple. So it all kind of seems fairly straightforward in hindsight. At one stage, there was a really impressive-looking move off the front with Bob Jungels of Quickstep and Maxime Monfort of Lotto Sudal away. But it was on the final climb, the Puerto del Garbi, which was where Marcinski and Mas really put the pressure on, and they were together and were later joined by Poliański, and the three of those went to the finish, and it was the Lotto rider Marcinski who was faster than the other two. There was also a bit of GC racing today. Alberto Contador looking very good again. He made a move on the climb with around 40 kilometres to go, and that forced Chris Froome to react, and for a while the two of them were in a little group, but on the descent all the favourites came back up to them. I think we may hear Fran say that Alberto Contador not terribly happy that Chris Froome didn't contribute to the effort. TJ Van Garderen, who was second overall this morning, crashed with Carlos Betancourt. Van Garderen chased very hard. He fell again on the run into the town here on a roundabout with about 3 kilometres to go. Impressive effort, though, because he only lost 20 seconds in the end to Chris Froome and slips from second to fourth. Everyone else in the top 10 is roughly where they were this morning. A little bit of movement, but further down, Romain Bardet has lost almost 7 minutes. So not a great day for him in terms of trying to finish high up overall. So Froome still in red, Trentin still in green, Villela still in the King of the Mountains. And on Van Garderen and his terrible luck, may well speak about that in the second part. But yeah, he was the only rider who sort of had a bit of a shocker GC-wise today. A
lot of battered bodies at the finish, so some nasty crashes. Peter Stettiner was another one. I didn't realise he'd fallen off, but he was a faller as well, so he was badly hurt. But I guess the man of the day in a lot of respects, well, let's not disregard or overlook the Polish 1-2. That can never have happened, I don't think, before in a Grand Tour. Has it? Status?
I wouldn't have thought so.
Your motherland, Daniel?
Maybe.
What about the time trial in Marseille?
Bodnar and Kwiatkowski.
Exactly. Oh my goodness.
Not 3 weeks ago.
Definitely not happened in the last 3 weeks.
Oh,
has it,
good really? Good memory. Yeah. That's a really good point.
But a great one too for Poland. Yeah.
Yeah.
And for Granada, since Tomasz Marcinski lives here since a handful of years ago.
You know him very well, don't you, Fran?
Yeah, I used to run into him while training and also at bars and so on, you know. we used to share a lot of paths, and yeah, quite friendly guy, takes very seriously his training, professional, great domestic, especially in the mountains, and well... He had been chasing this kind of triumph for his whole life, because he had been Polish champion for 7 times, I think. And now he got finally his great victory on TV.
And he's ridden in some pretty modest teams, hasn't he? He was at the Turkish team Torku a few years ago and the Italian team Mich. And he's really... Well, he's a classic journeyman. And I mean, I spoke to him at the finish and said that today's win was proof that, you know, you need to persevere and never give up, and he agreed with that you know, it's been a real story of perseverance his whole career, because he's not young, he's in his early
33, 30s. Yeah.
So, but the man of the day apart from that was probably Alberto Contador. Made a difficult stage, an exciting stage where quite a lot happened, and a few people asking, you know, what was it worth it, the attacks that he launched. There's still a long way to go. But, you know, who knows? I mean, would the crash have happened without the pressure that Contador had put on? You know, all sorts of things happened in the race. There was very unfortunate to see, and we've seen it a couple of times at the Vuelta, I thought some of the motorbikes were far too close to the riders. Condor was getting right up behind them. They seemed to be in the way on the descent as well. There were a lot of dropped riders coming back on the descent, and the motorbikes were getting stuck behind them. That may have also contributed to the crash. I don't know. We don't really know the circumstance of the crash. The irony of the motorbikes being too close is that the TV pictures were terrible. It was appalling. So something not quite right in all of that. But Alberto Contador, a sort of vintage Contador performance in the sense that he was attacking, he was putting people in difficulty. Esteban Chavez was dropped for the first time in this Vuelta. At the finish, I spoke to Steven de Jong, Alberto Contador's coach, really, isn't he? He's his coach rather than his sports director. Here's what he had to say. Alberto obviously wasn't himself on the stage in Andorra, but has he put that behind him? Is much better. It looks much better now.
Yeah. He passed a bad day with his stomach, and in the evening also was very bad. So yeah, it was not good, but at least that explained his performance in Andorra, where he just didn't have any energy because the food was not digested. But yesterday was, really promising signs from him, and today he confirmed that he's back on a good level. So that's good for us, and I think there's still a lot for us to play.
He certainly hasn't given up, clearly. I mean, was today a stage that I think a lot of people weren't really thinking about today as a GC day, but was it a stage that you'd looked at and thought there would be an opportunity today for him to attack in the way that he did?
Well, Alberto knew the climb very well, that last climb, because he had a house in Valencia and he's training on this road. So he knew this climb, and he said, if I feel good, maybe I can make a surprise here. And so he felt good, apparently.
And, I mean, what are his ambitions now? Some of his teammates the other day saying he's really not giving up on the idea of winning this Vuelta.
Well, he's still fighting there, and he wants to do damage to all the guys in front of him. That's what he did today. So he will never give up. He will surrender until Madrid, and that's the way he wants to be remembered.
So that was Steven de Jong. Nice line at the end there. I thought he will attack all the way to Madrid because that's how he wants to be remembered, is what Steven de Jong told us there.
Well, she said it was vintage Contador. I mean, I think that sort of almost takes it out of the recent context. What really struck me about Contador's attack today was that it was like winding the clock back not just a few months or a year or two, it was like winding it back 10 years. And he was really dancing on the pedals, really incredibly dynamic on the climb. And Chris Froome tonight said that he went as close to his limit as he had done at any point in the Tour de France. And Contador has been transformed, hasn't he, over the last 3 days. Apparently he came into this Wells in fantastic form. I mean, I think he even had surprised himself. I don't know what that's based on, whether it's numbers or just how he felt in training sessions, but he felt fantastic. And the stomach problems that he had the other day, remind me where the finish was.
In Andorra.
That obviously knocked him sideways, took him by surprise slightly, but he has returned to the norm of where he thinks he should be.
Just nervous that Daniel might get hauled off by the dancing on the pedals police.
Is that a banned phrase? Is it?
No, it's just one of them ones, isn't it?
He really. Of all the guys who
the phrase was invented.
Use that idiomatic expression for Contador really does look he's kind of grooving.
He literally dances on the pedals. He literally dances on the pedals.
He was grooving.
Fran,
yeah,
you spoke to or you listened in to Contador at the finish. What was he saying?
Yeah, he was, as always, playing this narrative of he being very happy that people had enjoyed the stage, that it had been a beautiful performance by him and by everyone, and that was the most important thing to him. Yet when the journalists insisted in pointing out that Froome hasn't cooperated with him and that probably harmed the effectiveness of the move, well, he did indeed beat that bite and said that he was a bit disappointed with Froome's attitude. Later on, Froome was addressed on that point, was asked about that, and he said that at this point of the race, he doesn't need to distance anyone.
Well, that's absolutely right. He didn't. I mean, Contador in the end didn't really gain anything, and so there was a lot of effort, a lot of bullets fired there for no gain. But Froome doesn't need to need to help him in that escape. And you know, he's in the position, as he said last night, he wants to be in a defensive position.
Well,
and that's the position he's in.
I mean, you look at the general classification now. Who's got the general classification to hand? Fran? So, Froome is 11 seconds ahead of Chavez. He's actually 3 minutes and 11 seconds ahead of Chavez, because you can... Well, we can be fairly sure that he'll be 3 minutes better than Chavez over a 40-kilometre time trial, or 2 minutes at least. So yeah, that's how strong his position is currently.
And Contador's still 3:10 down. I mean, yeah, he gained nothing today in terms of closing the gap to Chris Froome. But, you know, by racing like that, he's bound to sort of gallop up the standings, particularly with so many mountains still to come.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to our wonderful sponsor, RAFA. And a reminder that you can buy some RAFA designed and produced cycling podcast themed clothing, Pedal de Charme t-shirts, casquettes and cycling jerseys. Some sizes of those have unfortunately sold out, but they will be available again soon. And the time has come to announce our shortlist for Pedal de Charme for week one of the Vuelta. We'll be awarding a Pedal de Charme t-shirt every week. And there's been a long list, lots of nominations as ever. Few late nominations for Lachlan Morton, but he wasn't on the long list, so you can't be added to the short list having not been on the long list. But he was up there in the break today, Lachlan Morton. I think we'll see more of him, and I'm sure he'll be in contention the next couple of weeks for Pedal de Charme. So do get your nominations in for him for next week. But the shortlist of four is Mirhawi Kudus, Jack Haig, Julian Alaphilippe, and Larry Warbass.
Any idea why these people have been nominated?
Captain America. There's nothing to... Why, Lionel? Why?
Well, there has to be a compelling story, you know, behind...
I thought they might all fit a medium t-shirt. No, that's not true. Certainly Julian Alaphilippe will take, I think, an extra small. And Kudus, for that matter.
Alaphilippe is a charming peddler.
He is. He's actually won it once before, but he's a charming all-round chap. I mean,
Larry Warbass is wearing his Stars and Stripes Rafa shoes, which are very charming.
Not to mention the Stars and Stripes jersey as well, as American champion. He does look great. I mean, he looks fantastic.
Mirhawi Kudus was excellent yesterday. And
gave us a very nice interview as well. He's quite a dude, actually, Mirhawi Kudus. So it's a strong, first short
we'll
shortlist.
We'll see what the people decide.
We'll put the poll out tonight and see what happens.
Can I lobby for Jack Haig?
You can, Jack Haig.
I met Jack Haig the other day, and we spoke for like a couple of minutes, and we spent most of the time cracking jokes. And he told me that he had spent the Friday swimming on the bout pools.
What? Hang on, run that by me again. Swimming under bout pools.
On the bout pool of the auto.
The what?
on the bout pool. Of the odor.
The Vout pool. Vout pool. What's
the
that?
The pool. The swimming pool. Come on.
The water pool. Water pool.
The water pool. Like the Skyrider. Come on. Okay. I know it's an awkward joke, but for me it was very funny.
Oh my goodness me. And that's you lobbying for him. My goodness me. I'm not sure that's going to win any votes.
Okay. Anyway. Cut it out.
Everything stays in.
Back to the race. Daniel's had to skip off for a bit. He'll be back at the end. But let's talk about today's...
Oh, yes. Sorry. Yeah, there was a stage today. Yeah.
Sorry, Richard. Stage.
Well, let's hear actually from Neil Stevens, the sports director at Orica Scott. His riders, Esteban Chavez and the Yates twins, had quite a difficult day today, and I was just keen to get his thoughts on that. Here is Neil Stevens.
A bit of a scare there today. I don't know how aware you were following of the crash and the fact that Esteban got held up behind
it. I don't really know what happened out there. It was all a bit hectic. You know, there was attacks, there was crashes, there was all sorts of things going on. I was just trying to make some calm, cool, calm decisions and try to relate to the riders. And so, yeah, it was really hectic out there. I hope the riders that crashed get through okay. I saw there's a couple of guys that are pretty hurt, so unfortunately that's part of racing.
Another tough stage today. Were you expecting it to be as tough as that?
No, I wasn't expecting it to be that tough, but anyway, the boys reacted well. Yeah, we were caught a little bit on the back foot there at one stage, but I think they reacted well, and so we pulled through the stage pretty well, really.
Not all the information in the roadbook appears to be really accurate when it comes to the climbs and so on.
I think most of the directors around here know more, a little bit more than the roadbook. I drove over this stage a couple of times, and so yeah, I think most of the other directors have done the same.
Are you pleased with how Esteban's been riding so far? You must be delighted, given that he has had a difficult year, and he seems to be back to his best form here.
Yeah, Esteban's going well. He has had a difficult year, but all the boys are riding well, and so I'm really happy with the performance of all the boys.
You've got such an interesting lineup, you know, the two Yates brothers and Esteban. Will there come a point in the race where they'll all get behind one leader, or would you like to keep things quite fluid?
I'd like to keep it a bit of support all round as long as we can. And then and I think we've got more cards to play as we go through the race.
So that was Neil Stevens admitting that the stage today was a little bit harder than they had anticipated, though he did say they knew the roads, they knew the climbs. Another team, interesting, that knew these roads very well were Team Sky. And I don't know if you can cast your mind back, Lionel, to 2010, when they'd just been launched, Team Sky, and they, you know, they were determined to do things differently, and they, in choosing their location for their winter training camp, they came to Valencia on the basis of having studied 10 years worth of data about weather, and they decided it was the driest place in Europe. I don't think many other teams came specifically to this part of the world. Anyway, they arrived, and it basically rained for the entire time they were here. I think it even snowed at one point as well, but in terrible weather, and they were, as Team Sky tend to do, they were there. It was sort of like a holding camp. They were there for about three months. But what they did do in that time was they actually wrecked a lot of the roads around here. So they knew these roads very well. Nicola Portal, their sports director, knows them very well, knows the climb that they went up today. And Chris Froome, of course, as well, would have trained on these roads back then too. But TJ Van Garderen.
Yeah, TJ Van Garderen had a difficult day as well, although not all... not in terms of struggling to make the moves or what have you, but he crashed not once but twice. No details as we're speaking now about exactly what happened in the first crash, but he picked himself up quickly, rode very well to limit his losses. It was the little crash on the run into town that could have undone him a bit more, but I spoke to Yvonne Ludanois, the BMC sports director, after the finish, and he said that, you know, they'd taken the decision, the quickest thing to do was to give him a new bike rather than change a wheel. I think he'd damaged maybe his rear mech or something on the bike he was originally riding, so he swapped his bike, you know, that's presumably got brand new tyres on it. And of course, coming down here, not far from the sea, there's probably quite a lot of sand and grit and what have you on the roads. But Van Garderen, I mean, you sometimes wonder, what has he done to deserve such a run of terrible luck? I mean, we were talking about how promisingly he started the Giro earlier this season, and then he just seemed to completely collapse. I mean, he had one bad day after another, and yet he came good again and won a stage before the end. Here, you know, he's ridden the first few days pretty well. Today, he's really fought back in to limit his losses, when it would have been perhaps easier, you know, it would have been easy just to kind of go, well, I've fallen off and, you know, I'm going to lose a minute here. But he's actually, I think it shows signs of kind of mental resilience, mental toughness that perhaps he didn't have at the first half of the Giro.
After all, this has been a disaster year for BMC and the Grand Tours. Remember at the Giro d'Italia, they also lost Rohan Dennis in the stage 3 or 4 because of an unfortunate crash, lost later Van Garderen. And in the Tour de France, they had this also very freak crash with Richie Porte that hurt him badly and took him out of contention when he seemed really poised to be a podium rider in the Paris.
The cycling podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. And a reminder, you can get 20% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the discount code CPAUG. 20. So fill your boots with energy gels, caffeine gels, and whatever else takes your fancy. Listen, in this final part, we were going to turn our attention to a rider who really has caught the eye in the first few days of the Vuelta on the stage to Andorra, and also on the mountainous stage yesterday, the final climb certainly. That's Gianni Moscon, the young Italian rider, riding his first Grand Tour. He was fifth, I think, in Paris-Roubaix, so he's a very versatile rider. But I mentioned last night that he'd been the centre of controversy this year. That owed to an incident at the Tour de Romandie where he abused a rider on France du Jeu, Kevin Reza, using racist language. I'm not saying allegedly, because he did, and he was punished by his team with a six-week suspension from racing, and he was also to go on some diversity awareness training. Not sure what stage that is at, but we were talking about him a bit last night over dinner, Lionel, and today, and you know, just how he is a young rider. He's made a mistake, he's done something that's beyond the pale, but it's gonna be a cloud over his career, I think, and we saw that in the reaction to his incredible performance yesterday, because he's not actually taken, he's been punished for the offence, but he hasn't taken responsibility for it. He's spoken quite ambiguously about it. He gave an interview to Gazzetta dello Sport, and I know, Daniel, you spoke to him this morning as well. You spoke to Dave Brailsford too, but he, to my mind at least, he has not yet properly apologised or taken responsibility for having committed the crime.
Daniel, you spoke to him this morning. What actually happened? And I mean, obviously, because he'd been so prominent in the race yesterday, and it, I guess the first opportunity you've had to speak to Moscon since the Tour of Romandy, when he used this abusive and racist language to Kevin Reza. So the first opportunity you've had to actually raise it, and you chose to ask a question about it.
Well, what he said was very simple, Lionel. He said that in his opinion, enough has already been said about it, and that he didn't want to talk about it any further. Then spoke to Dave Brailsford, the Team Sky principal. He was a lot more elaborate and a lot keener to discuss it. He said that Moscon is taking it seriously, has taken it seriously, and needed to take it seriously, because it was a very, very serious issue. And worth pointing out, I suppose, that Kevin Reza himself gave an interview with L'Equipe, or to L'Equipe, at the Tour de France, in which he said he was very satisfied with the way Sky had dealt with it. They'd suspended Moscon for 6 weeks. I remember there was some debate and discussion at the time about, you know, what those 6 weeks actually deprived Moscon of. It was probably going to be a bit of a dead period in his season anyway. He'd done a lot of racing in the first part of the season, so, you know, was it a bit of a hollow gesture to suspend him for those 6 weeks? And Reza didn't think so, and he thought the appropriate action had been taken.
He missed the Italian Championships, didn't he,
as
a result of the suspension. I think more to the point is the fact that the UCI took no further action. I mean, really, I suppose on the one hand you could say, well, Team Sky have been proactive by suspending the rider. The UCI were probably put in a difficult position then, because, well, what could they do? If they then suspended him for six weeks, it would have run concurrently. But I think they should have done that. Symbolically, they should have done that. Rather than saying, well, he's been punished by his team, let's all move on, I think that it was important for the governing body to stamp on it and say, well, if teams that aren't going to take the same approach of Sky, this will be what the consequence will be. Richard, you say it will hang over Moscon, and I think at the moment it does, and certainly in my mind I suddenly felt uncomfortable talking about Moscon in glowing terms as a bike racer yesterday, because it's the first time I've seen him in action since the Tour of Romandy. But remember Michael Albosini, who was riding for Orica or Green Edge or whatever they were called at the time, 2014. He made a similar and arguably worse comment to Reza during the 2014 Tour de France, and you know, that kind of got, you know, again, shut down. The debate didn't really happen, and everybody moved on. And I think that it does need to be talked about, not least by Moscon himself, is because I've spoken to a lot of footballers who played in England in the late 70s and early 80s, when racism was a real problem, not just on the terraces but also on the pitch. And it took so long to stamp that out and make it clear to people that it was unacceptable, because the football authorities didn't want to tackle it head on. And at the moment we have a peloton which is it's not diverse at all. You know, there's a handful of non-white riders. We may have a situation in the next 10 to 15 years where, particularly with the work that Dimension Data are doing, opening up a whole continent, a predominantly non-white continent, Africa, thinking and during the World Athletics Championships, you know, who knows, maybe in 10, 15 years' time, the Tour de France top 10 will be filled with Ethiopian cyclists or Kenyan cyclists. And I think it's important that the peloton, which is a society on wheels, establishes what is correct and what is not correct, what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. However, moving it on another direction, I do also accept that the language of particularly Italy, Spain, you know, it's not necessarily aligned with the UK, where, you know, it's basically totally unacceptable to use that kind of language in the UK, and it's not reached a point where it's totally unacceptable perhaps in Spain or Italy.
On the UCI, Lionel, they did suspend Andre Greifko earlier this year for 45 days for punching Marcel Kittel. So, you know, there are certainly precedents for suspending riders from racing if they are deemed to have committed some kind of punishable offence. And for the UCI to take no action at all on this and to say that, well, the Team Sky's action is... it's fine. I think that's a dereliction of their responsibility.
Yeah, I agree, Rich, particularly when, I mean, one of the few areas in which we've praised the UCI, I've certainly praised them in the last few months and years, is that they've actually done a lot of good work in Africa in terms of opening the sport up. And, you know, Dimension Data is partly of a result, it's partly a result of some of the work that UCI has been doing in Africa. So I would have thought that they would have taken that responsibility a bit more seriously.
We'll probably return to this because it remains unresolved, but... it is, as I said earlier, I think it's a cloud hanging over Moscon. And that's sad because he is a talented rider. We've seen glimpses of that talent this year. Paris-Roubaix was outstanding. And here at the Vuelta, he's been a real revelation. I was speaking to Rod Ellingworth, the Sky race coach at the finish, and I was saying, you know, he can't keep that kind of up for 3 weeks. He says, well, we don't know what he's capable of. He's so... keen, he has to be held back a lot. He's very enthusiastic. Interestingly, he did say he does have quite a temper on the bike. He's very laid back and mellow off the bike. On the temper, he gets very, very het up, and he has to be sort of calmed down a lot by some of the other riders. But I think, Daniel, you were going to talk a bit about him as a rider.
No, I think Sky are quite conflicted, and I think he's quite conflicted in this issue of whether he's going to be a stage racer or a classics rider. His better results thus far have come in the classics, and you know, physically, to look at him, you would say maybe he fits the profile more of a classics rider. He's relatively tall. He's quite stocky. So actually, this was a conversation that arose over dinner with my travelling companion Scott the other day. The shortest winner of Paris-Roubaix in the last 30 years is how tall, would you say?
Good stat. Wow. The shortest winner.
Who would it be?
In the last
say
how long?
30 years. It might go back further than that, but we looked at the last 30 years.
Bernardino is like 5'7" or something, isn't he?
Yeah, well, that's about the same height as Peter Van Petegem, who's the shortest, 176.
Is that right? I didn't know Van Petegem was that short.
Yeah, but no one's shorter than that. So, and Moscon's a relatively tall guy, isn't he? And he has the build of a very good classics rider, very powerful, but... you know, on the one hand, he thinks that he's better suited to the classics at the moment. On the other, he was inspired growing up by the Grand Tours. They were the races that made him dream, in spite of living round the corner from and having been mentored by a great classics rider, Maurizio Fondrias. But I think he's treating these 3 weeks as a bit of a voyage of discovery. He doesn't know how good he can be, how good he's going to be. Having said that, you know, I think today underlined that, you know, we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves in terms of predicting that Moscon is going to be the next Chris Froome or Sky's heir to Chris Froome, because, you know, he lost significant time today. He's a fair way down on general classification. There are sporadic, brilliant performances in the mountains on steep climbs, but he's still a long way away. Although, having said that, Dave Brailsford didn't rule that out, that he would be the next in line in Sky's lineage of Grand Tour riders.
Well, Paul's had a better day today. But speaking of Paris-Roubaix, Daniel, was there not another significant date today? Monsieur Paris-Roubaix?
Mr. Paris-Roubaix. He's not really a friend of the... he's more than a friend of the podcast. He's more than a friend of the
soul
podcast.
Soul sister.
The icon. Icon. Yes, soul sister. Icon of the podcast. Roger de Vlaeminck turned 70 today. Winner of all five monuments, of course, in his career. Winner of all sorts of other races, owner of a llama, owner of a full-size football pitch as well in his garden, supporter of about 20 different football teams across Europe, all round hilarious character. I think I was asked on Twitter today, you know, for, because we tend to season the podcast every now and again with a Roger de Vlaeminck anecdote or two, don't we? Haven't had one for a while, and I can't remember, did we ever tell the cockfighting one? I think we did, didn't we?
Yeah,
that rings
still
a bell.
That's still probably my favourite, that, you know, a colleague of ours, a Belgian colleague, I probably won't name him, but he went to interview with Roger de Vlaeminck at his farm a few months ago, or probably a year or two ago now, and I think after the interview, Roger was giving him a lift to the station or something, and Roger got a phone call, was prattling away on the phone, and he'd obviously received a proposition, he was weighing it up, and then he said no, ultimately, he wasn't gonna go with whatever was being proposed, and he turned to the journalist and said, hang on a second, would you like to buy a fighting cock?
And then, yeah.
And of course our colleague, who shall remain nameless,
declined.
No.
Yeah. On that note, shall we end for tonight?
Well, I want to join Daniel to go and have dinner and discuss the heights of classic
winners. Should we end by singing Happy Birthday? Should we get Fran to sing Happy Birthday to Roger de Vlaeminck? No, we won't do that to you, Fran. We've already put you on the spot once tonight. So that's we'll wrap it up there. Lionel, this is your last podcast of the first part of the Vuelta.
Mm, yeah, I'll be back, though. I'll be back in the third week.
And it cools down when it cools down a bit, when we're up north.
Yeah, I'll look forward to that.
Out of the heat.
I hope you'll be paying a bit more attention by then. You know.
Yeah, that won't be a holiday.
You're a bit of a wild pulls at this world, aren't you? You're going to come good in the third week. Anyway, that's all for tonight. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Good evening, chaps.
Thank you, Lionel.
See you later in the race.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Fran.
Thank you all.